This episode of Onward to Victory is proudly presented by our good friends at West Coast Screen Printing and Embroidery at wcscreens.com. You've heard their name for years now, and for good reason. If you have needs with screen printing, embroidery, customized promotional items for your company, organization, or more, head over to wcscreens.com and get with my friend Tony and the rest of his team. They have nationwide shipping, wholesale pricing, and exemplary customer service. Not only are they big supporters of this podcast, but like you, they are also diehard fans of the Fighting Irish. Score a touchdown with wcscreens.com. And on with the show. Today on Onward to Victory, how about some love for those seven mules? Most every Notre Dame football fan knows of the vaunted four horsemen. How about the guys up front who opened up the running lanes during the Irish's national championship season of 1924? Join us as we do a little dive on those unsung heroes who, quite literally, paved the way for the iconic four horsemen during that historic season. So buckle up those chin straps, Irish fans. This is Onward to Victory. Hello all and welcome to Onward to Victory, a Notre Dame football podcast. My name is Alex Painter and welcome all to chapter 94 of this podcast. I do think you are going to enjoy this one. It's a topic that rests in very close proximity to perhaps one of the most famous units in college football history, and certainly Notre Dame football history, in the Four Horsemen. So yes, Irish fans, we are actually going to talk about the Four Horsemen today, but we are really here to talk about the Seven Mules. We are going to absolutely talk on who they were, what makes them interesting, perhaps a bit about how Coach Knute Rockne used them to optimal and, for opposing teams, devastating effect. So this is all very appropriate, by the way, as this football season marks the 100th anniversary of not just the Four Horsemen, but of course the Seven Mules as well. And around here, we pride ourselves on getting the story out to you first. So best I can tell, this is some of the very first content that has been created about the Four Horsemen this year. But really, the Seven Mules, by my estimation anyways, as an amateur Notre Dame historian, they haven't really gotten much of a treatment. And so I hope to maybe shore that up a little bit today, because they are awful important, and boy, were they really interesting and impressive. But before we jump in, a couple housekeeping items. First, I hope you had a chance to listen to episode 93, which was released late last month. It was about the Irish potato famine and its significance, not just as a world event, or perhaps more astutely as an Irish tragedy, but also the profound impact it had beyond Ireland, such as in the United States, and in particular, for the purposes of this podcast, the University of Notre Dame. I promise you this, though the subject matter can be a bit tough to stomach at times, it's truly worth every minute of your time. For being a Notre Dame football podcast, the potato famine episode has actually fared really well in terms of listens and downloads, and being someone who has studied history in college and continues that study today, I sincerely appreciated having the opportunity and platform to pull off such an episode. But I suppose if one Notre Dame football podcast, and there are quite a few of them, mind you, could do a potato famine episode, and virtually few would be surprised, if any, I guess it's this one. So for that, I do indeed thank you. And speaking of thank yous, a sincere acknowledgement here for the show's financial sponsors, We call them the consensus All-Americans. We're going to talk about a couple of those consensus All-Americans in Notre Dame football history today. But these folks have either contributed significantly in the past or are currently donating to the show's efforts, and they are Dr. Jeremy Scarlett, Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin, Brad Glazier of Williamsburg, Indiana, author and writer Will Fuller of Warren, Ohio, Andy Nickel of South Bend, Indiana, and Michael Finan of Rutherford, New Jersey. If you would like to chip in yourself and make the prestigious muster roll of the consensus All-Americans, please visit paypal.me/onwardtovictory if you're interested in a one-time donation, or patreon.com/onwardtovictorypodcast for monthly contributions. Please know that this comes with a very gracious thank you. And of course, I'd be remiss not to mention that this show is powered by West Coast Screen Printing and Embroidery. You can find them at wcscreens.com. So please jump over to them with any screen printing or embroidery needs. Also, this podcast is now also sponsored by Augie's Locker Room in South Bend, the premier shop for Notre Dame memorabilia and gifts. No trip to campus would be complete without a stop at my good old pal Augie's. One-of-a-kind items, gifts, relics. He's even dedicating some space for museum-like exhibits in his new location. And speaking of new location, he is at 1733 North Ironwood Drive. It's just a stone's throw from the old location, but the same Augie that you know and love. Augie's Locker Room. Really quickly here, finally, don't forget to like, subscribe, or leave a review for this podcast. As we are here entering the show's fifth year, these are the things that allow it to continue to grow. Word of mouth is certainly the most effective way to keep getting this thing out there. I do really appreciate all the help on this front, and I tell you, these things sure take quite a while for me to put together, these episodes, that is. But I am truly having the time of my life putting together the most comprehensive and accessible Notre Dame history available to anyone, completely free of charge, of course. So thank you once more. Pass it on. And now moving on. Just for some ease, let's talk about the Four Horsemen really quick. Let's get acclimated or reacclimated with these guys. So Harry Stoldreher was the quarterback. Harry was a Massillon, Ohio guy. He has to be one of the smallest quarterbacks in Notre Dame history. He was exactly 5'7", and he tipped the scales at 151 pounds. Even then, and people were smaller back then, he was a petite man, but especially one playing football. And since we're on the topic of heights and weights, the backfield, the Four Horsemen on average stood 5'10", and weighed 161 pounds. So while Stoldreher brought the mean down a little bit, you do get the idea that none of these guys were behemoths. Anyway, at right halfback was Don Miller. There is an episode about Don and his family, and his family's Notre Dame football legacy. That would be episode 51. His older brother Harry, known as Red, was on that 1909 team, which there is also an episode about, episode 47, which I discuss the origins of the Fighting Irish nickname, because that has everything to do with Don's older brother's team in 1909. Anyways, Jim Crowley suited up at left halfback. Elmer Layden held down fullback. Layden was the subject of episode 81. By the way, it's probably obvious now, but I'm trying to be a little bit more intentional about connecting current episodes to past efforts. And this is just in case, as a listener, you may want to learn more context about some of these things that I kind of have to breeze by during some of these episodes based on the subject. But I'm trying to create this rich tapestry here of Notre Dame football history and some of the things, again, that I have to kind of breeze by depending on the episode subject I've actually covered in depth in other episodes. So there you go. But the quartet of Irish stars, again, that is Stoldreher, Miller, Crowley, and Layden, carried that 1924 team to an undefeated season. And they are forever immortalized by the words of sports writer Grantland Rice, who wrote a much longer soliloquy, by the way, but the meat of it was, quote, outlined against a blue-gray October sky, the Four Horsemen rode again. In dramatic lore, they are known as famine, pestilence, destruction, and death. These are only aliases. Their real names are Stoldreyer, Miller, Crowley, and Leyden, end quote. At the time, there was a concerted effort to make sure that the Four Horsemen moniker that Grantland Rice had bestowed upon this group stuck. So after the team returned to South Bend from their game against Army in New York, where they beat the Cadets, as they were known at that time, 13-7 at the famous Polo Grounds, the game which had inspired Rice to write his famous words, Coach Knute Rockne was not going to let a good opportunity slip right through his fingers. So he took his press aide, whose name was George Strickler, out to the practice field with a camera. He didn't just have his camera, though. He actually had borrowed four horses from a local South Bend livery stable. So he posed the Irish backfield in their full game gear on the horses, and he snapped that legendary photograph. Soon, it was spread throughout the wire services, and then all of a sudden, at the drop of a hat, every newspaper in the country could run the picture. That Army game, by the way, which kind of immortalized these four, was on October 18th, 1924. Don Crowley, who was a Four Horseman, later said, quote, "At the time, I didn't realize the impact it would have, but the thing just kind of mushroomed. After the splurge in the press, the sports fans of the nation got interested in us, along with other sports writers." End quote. Also, if you look at the photograph, Crowley himself looks very uncomfortable atop the horse. Some folks have mentioned and written on over the years about the backs and how they all had varying levels of comfort aboard the horses. But Crowley himself was actually uncomfortable for a completely different reason. He actually had a boil on his buttocks, which couldn't have felt that great. But anyway, over the decades, I guess now the century, a lot of ink has been dedicated to these four guys, and with good reason. All four are in the College Football Hall of Fame. Leyden was the first one elected in 1951. Stoldreyer followed in 58, Crowley in 1966, and Miller in 1970. But what about the other guys on Coach Rockne's 1924 team? It wasn't long after the backfield was dubbed the Four Horsemen that the offensive line earned its nickname of the Seven Mules. And I gotta tell you, this one comes by way of Ray Robinson's book called Rockne of Notre Dame. But there was a healthy rivalry between the offensive line and the uber-famous backfield. Reputedly, while the backfield was getting photographed up top the horses, the Seven Mules stood nearby and dispensed disparaging wisecracks at the expense of the horsemen. Throughout the rest of the season, many of the mules talked amongst themselves about some of the minor disdain they had for the horsemen and all the publicity they got. But you have to understand just how good these mules were as a unit. And I suppose it was only human. But to Harry Stoldreyer's credit, he used some ink in his autobiography to talk about the mules. He insisted that, quote, "They never got their share of the glory. Without the Seven Mules to kick up the dust for them, the backfield would have stayed put. It was only through their work that the four of us did anything worth remembering," end quote. But how did the Mules' nickname actually come about? So if the Army game was October 18th of that season, the lads played Northwestern the next month on November 22nd. I have no clue if this is true or not, but I do love it, and I will say that it was printed in the 1924 Notre Dame Football Review, so there is that. But the Irish would ultimately beat Northwestern that day 13-6. And it was kind of a classic case that Northwestern saved their very best performance all year for Notre Dame. They had that date circled on their calendar, on their schedule. We see this a lot, even today. Teams kind of wanting to put it all on the line against the Irish. Anyway, the field that day was muddy, which really negated the speed of Rockne's boys, particularly those four horsemen. So frustrated that the game was far closer than he thought it should be, center Adam Walsh decided to give his teammates a verbal jolt as they were about to take the field as an offense, according to the 1924 Football Review. Quote, among other reasons, the Northwestern game will be famous for the historic crack made by Adam Walsh during the battle. Speaking to the line, composed of Mr. Weibel, Kaiser, Bach, Rittmiller, Hunsinger, and Collins, he said, come on, you mules, the horsemen are waiting, end quote. I've actually never heard this before researching this episode, as far as the provenance of the Seven Mules nickname, but I will be frank, I think it's super badass. But was this a sardonic remark? It is a bit ambiguous if Walsh may have meant the mule moniker as a positive one. And of course, that's if he said it at all. I'll be honest once more, I had never heard this origin story of how the nickname came about. But since this was in the 1924 Football Review, it's about as close to contemporary as it gets. But you know what it kind of reminds me of? The origin story of Stonewall Jackson's nickname. Yeah, the Civil War general. So again, letting my Civil War nerd flag fly here for a second. But it has long been a debate if the nickname was given to Jackson in a flattering fashion or as a bit of a pejorative dig. We'll never know. But regardless, the moment I read that, well, I just knew I had the title of this episode sewn up pretty quickly. But let's level set here briefly. We've been talking about the mules, but we haven't talked about just who they were. I just kind of threw out their names, but let's do a little dive on each. Let's start with the middle of the line. The center was named Adam Walsh, and he was every bit as good of a center as there was in the entire country that season. During the 1924 game against Army, again, the one where the Four Horsemen earned their nickname, Walsh played every minute of the football game with two broken hands. Not only did he play with two broken hands, he didn't misplay a single snap, not all game. Defensively, he was involved anecdotally in 75% of the tackles. And, I guess just as some sugar on top, he intercepted a pass late in the game to seal it for the Irish. Walsh was born in Iowa, but was raised in Hollywood, California. Rockne loved Walsh almost like a surrogate son, and that was something that Rockne actually wrote Walsh's parents to remind them of. Because back in the 20s, Hollywood, California, and South Bend, Indiana were about as far apart as it felt. And Walsh was actually named captain of the 1924 squad. And again, he was certainly one of Rockne's most trusted lieutenants. Also, folks still marvel about just how small, from a height and weight perspective anyway, that this team was, even for the time. We already mentioned how the backfield averaged 161 pounds. That's really light, but the line wasn't much bigger comparatively. They averaged 176 pounds. But bringing up that average was the center Adam Walsh. He stood 6 foot and weighed 190 pounds. He was, by quite a margin, the biggest dude of the Four Horsemen and the Seven Mules. Speaking frankly, he was probably the baddest dude among those men as well. And he was named an All-American in 1924. Rightfully so. Something that is really quite amazing about Notre Dame at this time is just how many of Rockne's players went on to become college football coaches. Rockne's coaching tree is truly immense. So Walsh, again, bears repeating, the guy who kind of reputedly came up with the nickname of the Seven Mules, became a college football coach immediately after graduating from Notre Dame in 1925. He took a position at Santa Clara University, where he spent the next four seasons through 1928. He then coached 20 non-consecutive seasons at Bowdoin College in Maine between 1935 and 1958. his teams outright won or shared the conference title 11 times during his tenure. And if Bowdoin College rings a bell, and you also happen to be a Civil War buff, Gettysburg hero Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain was president of the college from 1871 through 1883 and was also a professor there before the Civil War. So score for two Civil War references in one episode. Anyway, Walsh also coached two seasons in the NFL when Elmer Layden, one of the horsemen, was the commissioner of the league in the 1940s. You will find that these men are inextricably connected, and that's just the first of many connections that we will find. Okay, so let's kick the line out. We've talked about center Adam Walsh, so let's go to the left here. At left end, you had a gentleman named Chuck Collins, who was a New Jersey native, but someone who had done his schooling, though, at St. Ignatius in Chicago before landing with Rock's squad in South Bend. And here's one for you. According to Collins' obituary, he entered Notre Dame on a basketball scholarship. Over the years, Collins always shared an anecdote that the 1924 team used to vote amongst themselves as to who they thought was more valuable to the team. The backfield, the four horsemen, or the line, the seven mules. He jokingly said that the vote always ended up at 7-4. But Collins was yet another member of the 24 squad who pursued coaching. He coached the North Carolina Tar Heels from 1926 through 1933 to a total record of 38-31-9. So that he was left end. That takes us to left tackle. That was Joe Bock. Bock was a Chisholm, Minnesota guy who had actually attended Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota, before transferring to Notre Dame in 1922. Bock was a standout. He was named the second team to Walter Eckersall's All-Western 11 after the 1924 season. Bock, you could easily make the argument, was the second best lineman on that team, short of Adam Walsh. But he coached Duquesne University in Pittsburgh under teammate and horseman Elmer Layden before he himself took the reins in 1934 as head coach. Now, Bock got the role of head coach because Layden ended up taking the head coaching gig at Notre Dame. It was during the 1934 season that Layden took over the Notre Dame football team. He succeeded Hunk Anderson, who had succeeded Knute Rockne. So, there you go. But Bock had also coached at Niagara, Fort Knox, and St. Bonaventure. And he would actually make some bones in the professional ranks as well. Collegiately, he'd win almost 50 games as head coach, and he would spend a couple stints as head coach for the Pittsburgh Steelers in the 1930s and the 1950s. If you happen to jump on eBay, you'll find pretty quickly that he has a 1952 Bowman trading card as the Steelers' head coach. And I guess as a classic bit of not-for-nothing here, Joe Bock was backed up by another Joe, in Joe Boland. So Joe Boland was a second teamer, and that name may ring some bells for some of you. If it doesn't, here you go. In 1947, Joe Boland became the first voice of Notre Dame football in the newly formed Irish Radio Network. So this first group of stations, believe it or not, numbered nearly 200, which carried Notre Dame football games. Wow. I don't know about you, but I love listening to Notre Dame football on the radio. And I much strongly prefer to watch it on TV. But you know what? If I've ever been in a position over the last 10, 12 years that I can think of where I have to listen to the game instead of watch it, I'm so far from dismayed. I think the Irish Radio Network is one of still the coolest things. But when you think of the history of the Irish Radio Network, Joe Boland is your first voice of it. He remained a prolific radio announcer until his sudden passing in 1960. So as we move again to left guard, you had a gentleman named John Weibel of Erie, Pennsylvania. and in many respects, he was a prototypical Rockne ball player. Sure, he was undersized, all of them were. John only weighed 165 pounds. 165 pounds as a guard, but he was someone with a high IQ, football and otherwise. John was called, quote, one of the lightest guards in major college football, end quote. And he didn't come to Notre Dame to play football, not by a long stretch. John came to Notre Dame to study medicine, and he would eventually become a doctor. So that being said, he also came to Notre Dame without a football scholarship. You may detect a theme here. However, I guess to maybe kill some time or keep himself busy, he suited up in the Inner Hall Football League his freshman year with his Brownson Hall dorm mates. Now, Brownson Hall, just as a quick refresher, if you're a Notre Dame history student, you'll see Brownson Hall all the time. Brownson Hall actually stood until just a few years ago. It was right behind the main building or the Golden Dome. It was eventually demolished, again, not too terribly long ago. But Brownson Hall was one of the longest standing residence halls on campus when it was demolished. But he came out, Weibel that is, to the spring practices in 1922, and Rockne made sure he never suited up for his residence hall again. He elevated him to varsity almost immediately. But John would indeed become a doctor, and he did coach the line at Vanderbilt for 2 years while he completed medical school in 1925 and 1926. Now, he moved on to coach the line at Duquesne University in 1927 while he was in his residency at a Pittsburgh hospital. Sadly, though, Weibel passed away suddenly in February of 1931 after contracting appendicitis. Though he was a full-fledged doctor, he would still come out to the Duquesne practice and help coach the linemen. In 1930, the Duke's line coach was none other than fellow Mule Joe Bock. And of course, the head coach at the time was still Four Horseman Elmer Layden. Speaking a little bit broadly, this would have been a really tough time to be a Notre Dame backer because Weibel died in February of 1931 and his coach, Knute Rockne, would pass away, obviously, in a plane crash in March of 31. So that moves us to center, Adam Walsh. Well, we already talked about Walsh, but something that I think I failed to mention about Adam is that he is a member of the College Football Hall of Fame, along with the Horsemen. He was inducted in 1968, so after three of the Horsemen, but before Don Miller, who was put in 1970. But over to the right side of the line we go, beginning with right guard, who was a gentleman named Noble Kaiser. Noble was a local guy from nearby Plymouth, Indiana. Plymouth is about 30 or so miles south of South Bend. Marshall County, Indiana, if you're a Hoosier, might ring some bells. But actually, on game day weekends, I am sure that Plymouth sees an uptick in visitors. Speaking only for my family, I suppose, we have stayed in Plymouth ourselves on a game day weekend. But anyway, in Kaiser, Rockne had another prototypically non-prototypical fit. Yeah, that sounded weird, but it's true. Like fellow lineman Chuck Collins, Noble came to campus to play basketball. And like everyone on the line save Adam Walsh, he was also fairly light, clocking in at 165 pounds. And he was actually one of the older guys on the team. He had served in the Marine Corps during World War I, and so he was 24 years old during the 1924 season. And here's something else. Before reaching Notre Dame, Noble had never even played a single down of football. And that was pretty much unheard of by this point. Sure, for the first couple decades of Notre Dame football, it was fairly commonplace to have guys who had never played the sport participate at the varsity level. But by the mid-1920s, those guys were far fewer and farther in between. So what's more, after he graduated from Notre Dame, again, the guy who never played until he got to college, Kaiser coached seven seasons at Purdue University, from 1930 through 1936, and he was wildly successful there. He went 42-13, and he won two Big Ten titles. But like Weibel, Kizer also died young. He passed away suddenly in 1940 at the age of 40 in West Lafayette, Indiana, home of Purdue University. So at right tackle, again moving left to right, was Edgar Miller, but he was much more commonly called Rip. He was a Canton, Ohio native. Interestingly enough, and perhaps somebody can come in and get me if I'm speaking out of turn here, but Rip was inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame himself in the 1960s. He was put in 1966, so he got in even before Adam Walsh. However, and not to disparage Rip here, I'm not sure how that was. He was never selected as an All-American, which remains the litmus test for the College Football Hall of Fame. That very well might change sometime in the future, but certainly in 1966, the selection standards were still very rigid. But even at the time he was playing, senior year, he wasn't selected for any of the All-Western teams, such as those selected by Walter Eckersall. I'm not quite sure, but there you go. He is the second College Football Hall of Famer among the Mules. And also, if you're undoubtedly picking up a pattern here, Rip also coached college football. He helmed the Navy team for three seasons, from 1931 through 1933. He stuck around the program and coached the linemen from 1934 through 1947. And then finally, at right end, you had a chap named Ed Hunsinger. Like Noble Kizer, Hunsinger had never played football before college, and like John Weibel, he was another guy that Rockne had kind of discovered through the Interhall League. Hunsinger was just kind of described as all-around solid. In the 1925 Rose Bowl, which Notre Dame capped off their perfect 1924 season with a win over Stanford, by the way, at, Hunsinger pounced on a loose fumble for a touchdown in the ultimate 27-10 Irish win. Hunsinger would also go on to coach football after college, as they all did. As the line coach at Fordham University in the mid-1930s, Hunsinger coached the future great Vince Lombardi as a collegian. So hey, there's that. So here you go real quick. Seven Mules, two future College Football Hall of Famers. Only three came to Notre Dame to play football. Adam Walsh, Joe Bock, and Rip Miller. Once more, Bock was a transfer from Carleton College. Two came to Notre Dame to play basketball. Noble Kizer and Chuck Collins. Two didn't come to campus to play varsity football at all, but they were spotted as standouts in the Interhall League. John Weibel and Ed Hunsinger. Kizer and Hunsinger had never played a down of football before reaching college. Unless your name was Adam Walsh, all the Mules were very undersized comparatively for the task at hand. I bring all of this up because, wow, what a delightfully random group of guys that is, huh? And here's a note on how these guys were often used. This goes for both the Mules and the Horsemen. Coach Rockne liked to use what he thought of as his shock troops. These were his second string guys. So like, for instance, we talked about one, Joe Boland. And some of these linemen were like of the 200 plus pound variety. Big, sinewy, muscular, heavier than his first string O-line. But he'd often use that second string team to bludgeon the foe physically right out of the gate. Again, because his second team was often bigger. And then all of a sudden he would sub in his fleet of foot first unit who would just breeze right past the physically wore out opponent. Essentially, he would use his shock troops, again, just to wear down opponents until just the right moment. And he would insert his first stringers who would then run wild. Between the Horsemen and the Mules, backup fullback Harry O'Boyle was on record saying that he thought they were so good that, quote, the Holy Ghost couldn't have broken into that lineup, end quote. That's pretty good there. I like that. But the 1924 team went a perfect 10-0. National champions. Rose Bowl champions. Again, all of this hit 100 years ago this year. Now, I don't want to take away from the greatness that was the Four Horsemen. But knowing kind of how we know these things go, they will get their share of ink this season. No question. And when you undoubtedly see that legendary photograph taken by Mr. Strickler in 1924, don't forget about the seven guys who tore through the opposing lines with as much effectiveness and veracity as the horsemen did. The seven mules. Maybe even when you see that picture, perhaps think about some of the wise cracks the mules threw their way during the photo shoot as they stood just outside the coverage of the camera lens. Once more, Chuck Collins, Joe Bach, John Weibel, Adam Walsh, Noble Kaiser, Rip Miller, and Ed Hunsinger. I hope you enjoyed that one, Irish fans. And for today, I'll let you off the hook and let you go. So if you have anything you'd like to say to the show, please feel free to visit the Facebook page. Again, it's simply Onward to Victory, a Notre Dame football podcast found on Facebook. Or if you'd like to drop the show a line, an email, it's onwardtovictorypodcast@gmail.com. But I hope you enjoyed that. Boy, was it a blast to put together. But I'll let you go here in the interim. This has been Onward to Victory, a Notre Dame football podcast. And in kindness, I am your host, Alex Painter. And as always, go Irish!